Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Tuesday, March 26, 2013. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. At its regular meeting tonight, the city of Sitka will decide whether to protest the liquor license at a downtown hotel and bar. It says the establishment owes back taxes. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
On March 12th, the Assembly approved four liquor license renewals, including one for Victoria's Poorhouse. The Assembly will consider taking back its approval for Victoria's, which is attached to the Sitka Hotel. An email from a city tax accountant says the bar and hotel owes the city an estimated $90,000 in back sales and bed taxes and has not filed tax returns for the last half of 2012. The city email says it last received payment in November. Hotel management could not be reached by deadline for this story. A section of Alaska law allows cities to protest liquor licenses if a business owes back taxes above $200. In order for the Assembly to protest the liquor license at Victoria's, at least five members must vote to rescind the Assembly's earlier approval. The ultimate fate of a liquor license is up to the state's Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Liquor licenses aren't the only thing up for another look tonight. The Assembly might also undo its March 12th vote dealing with an ice machine. At the last meeting, the Harbor Department wanted to apply for a state grant and buy an ice machine for sport fishermen. But local resident Fred Reeder testified against the plan, saying there already are places to get ice and that the city should not compete with those businesses. City departments need approval to apply for big grants, and after hearing testimony at its last meeting, the Assembly said no to the Harbor Department. But then came letters from sport anglers, among others. They said recreational fishermen and charter boats don't have access to purchase ice, and that the ice machine would not be as energy inefficient as Assembly members believed. The grant is worth nearly $250,000. Assembly members have a work session at 5 p.m. tonight to get an update from the Ports and Harbors Commission. The regular meeting begins at 6, which is when Raven Radio will join live coverage. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
The Sitka Sound Science Center has a new fellow in town for its Scientist in Residency program. Allison Stimpert studies the sounds that animals make. It's a field called bioacoustics. Her focus is on the sounds of humpback whales, a common whale in the area, and the effects of human sound on the marine mammal.
I'm really interested in behavior, and sound is so important to whales because they spend so much time underwater. So it's a nice way to figure out some things about how they're behaving underwater when we can't see them.
Stimpert is interested in studying the sounds whales make when they feed. She has worked with whales for the last 15 years, but got interested in acoustics when she was in graduate school.
If we're lucky and the gray whales show up, we might make some recordings of gray whale feeding and humpback feeding as well, because I am interested in the differences between the sounds that animals make here when they're feeding versus, for example, in the Atlantic, where I've done some work, or in the Antarctic. They have slightly different acoustic repertoires, so it'll be an interesting comparison.
Stimpert will be here for a month on kind of a mini sabbatical, during which she will immerse herself in research as well as community engagement and outreach. She will be working with students at Sitka High School this week, where she and a scientific illustrator, Ron Holtheson, will explore the intersection between art and science. Holtheson is the founder of the Scientific Art Studio in Richmond, California. Holtheson will be giving a free talk called Dead Animals and Alcohol this week at the University of Alaska Southeast as part of the Natural History Series. He'll discuss his artistic process from finding a specimen to the creation of the model. It's at 7 p.m. on Wednesday in room 229 at the Sitka campus, and the Scientist in Residency Fellowship Program is funded by the National Science Foundation. A move to reduce funding for a new sex trafficking investigation unit has one high-profile critic, Alaska's First Lady Sandy Parnell. Parnell appeared in front of the Senate Finance Committee on Saturday to ask them to reconsider the state trooper budget. It was her first time testifying before legislators. Legislators stripped the $800,000 allocation from the governor's budget because the troopers did not investigate any trafficking crimes last year. The First Lady found that reasoning wanting.
The reason given for cutting the funding, however, is exactly why the funding is needed, because sex trafficking is a hidden crime that must be unearthed by investigators. Its victims do not self-report.
Parnell adds that right now, state troopers have limited experience in recognizing the signs of sex trafficking. She says sex trafficking cases are especially difficult to recognize, and that victims may not even realize what is happening to them.
The girls' identification and cell phones are taken. They are physically threatened and abused, and sadly, the girls have bonded with their captors.
Reducing sex trafficking has been a key issue for both the governor and first lady as part of the Choose Respect initiative. The Senate Finance Committee is currently reviewing the operating budget and is slated to consider changes to it this week. Money for this sex trafficking unit has been kept in the House version, and any differences between the two documents will have to be reconciled. John Muir is one of the most renowned naturalists of the last two centuries. Several presidents turned to his work when planning America's first national parks. In the late 1800s, Muir decided to make the journey to the far north in search of glaciers. His exploration would eventually lead to the creation of Glacier Bay National Park, just about 100 miles north of Sitka. But the first stop on his Great Alaska Expedition was Wrangel Island in the Inside Passage. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver traces the history of Muir in Wrangel, from his first steps on the island to his continued influence today.
The Wrangel Village was a rough place. No mining hamlet in the placer gulches of California, nor any backwoods village I ever saw, approached it in its picturesque, devil-may-care abandon.
That's Mike Simons reading an excerpt from John Muir's book, Travels in Alaska. Along with being the general manager of Wrangel's radio station, Simons is an avid Muir buff. He says, in May 1879, Muir boarded the steamer Dakota in San Francisco, bound for the wild north. He hoped to study some of the largest glaciers in America. He made stops in Oregon and British Columbia before finally reaching the territory of Alaska on July 14th. Muir was impressed by the great fjords and mountains of the Inside Passage that he saw from the ship. But his first impression of an Alaskan town left something to be desired.
Stumps and logs, like precious monuments, adorned its two streets. The ground, in general, was an oozy, mossy bog of a foundation of jagged rocks, full of concealed pit holes. There was not a horse on the island. The domestic animals were represented by chickens, a lonely cow, a few sheep, and hogs of a breed well calculated to deepen and complicate the mud of the streets.
Samuel Hall Young was the reverend of the Presbyterian Church in town. He would go on to travel up the Stikine River with Muir, but he first saw Muir while waiting at the shore to greet the travelers as they arrived. He noticed the strange, weather-beaten man on the ship as it came in.
Standing a little apart from them as the steamboat drew to the dock, his peering blue eyes already engagingly scanning the islands and the mountains, with a lean, sinewy man of 40, with waving reddish-brown hair and beard and shoulders slightly stooped. He was introduced as Professor Muir, the naturalist.
Kay J. Bush is the director of the Wrangel Public Library. She's holding a small blue book with yellowing pages. She reads the inscription scribbled on the first page.
This book, Alaska Days with John Muir by S. Hall Young, was presented to the Wrangel Public Library by the author, S. Hall Young, Wrangel, Alaska, October 28, 1921.
Jay Bush says having the personally inscribed book makes this community history real for readers today. Muir writes in his book that he can't find a place to camp for the evening, so he hikes up the mountain rising from the center of town. He says he hopes to find a more suitable place to camp in nature. When he gets to the top of the mountain, he builds a bonfire for warmth and to see the forest around him. The sky is overcast and the clouds are low and heavy. The fire reflects off the clouds in brilliant reds and oranges. As the story goes, Reverend Young and the townspeople are scared by the strange lights on the mountain. They eventually learn that it was just the naturalist keeping warm, but that night is still a rich part of local lore. Muir writes,
I've enjoyed thousands of campfires in all sorts of weather and places, but this Wrangel campfire, my first in Alaska, I shall always remember for its triumphant, storm-defying grandeur and the wondrous beauty of the psalm-singing, lichen-painted trees which it brought to light.
That place is now called Mount Dewey, but its first name, and one that some locals still use, was Muir Mountain.
The significance of Muir with Wrangel is that these exploratory trips, which put Glacier Bay on the map and made it the tourist destination that it became, these trips of such importance were started from Wrangell, Alaska, and would terminate in Wrangell, Alaska.
Muir continued on his journey through the Inside Passage and went on to travel across the interior and as far north as Barrow. But Muir writes he'd always remember the rough and tumble town of Wrangell as the place his Alaskan adventure began. Following the footsteps of John Muir in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
A federal judge has dismissed Alaska's court challenge of the roadless rule for national forest land. Alaska had the last remaining legal case against the 2001 nationwide rule, which prohibits new road construction, reconstruction, or logging on large undeveloped areas of national forest land across the U.S. It includes part of the Tongass and the Chugach National Forests in Alaska. U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon ruled this month that the state missed a six-year deadline for mounting its legal challenge. Tom Waldo is an attorney with Earth Justice, a nationwide environmental law firm representing several environmental groups. Those groups joined the case to defend the roadless rule, and Waldo calls the latest decision a complete victory.
Not only is it too late for the state of Alaska to bring its case, but it's too late for anyone to challenge the roadless rule. The rule has withstood all of the legal challenges that have been brought against it, and it's too late for any more legal challenges. It's time to move on.
The rule impacts over 58 million acres of forest land nationwide and was approved during the final days of the Clinton presidency. Democratic Governor Tony Knowles filed suit against application of the roadless rule in 2001. Then in 2003, the Bush administration's Justice Department agreed to a settlement with Republican Governor Frank Murkowski and the state of Alaska. KCAW, Sitka.